Freedom means different things to different people. But for Black Americans, the long journey to freedom has meant fighting to think freely, to have an education, and to be viewed as equal in society. The journey to freedom has led to countless Black Americans sacrificing for the cause of civil rights, including Martin Luther King Jr. and Medgar Evers. But years before those brave men were murdered, a Florida teacher and his wife became the first martyrs of the civil rights movement. This is the mystery of the murder of Harry T. Moore. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight. And I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Evangeline Moore was one of two daughters born to Harry T. and Harriet V. Moore. Evangeline was said to have suffered three tragedies in her life. The first, that her parents were murdered. The second, that the murders were never solved. And the third is that more than likely, you don't know who her parents were. Harry T. Moore and his wife, Harriet, are rarely mentioned in history books, and they're not listed on the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. That comes down to a historical timeline. The memorial remembers civil rights workers killed after the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954. The Moores were killed 3 years before that decision, murdered in their home in Mims, Florida, on Christmas Day, 1951. Harry Tyson Moore was born on November 18, 1905, in Houston, Florida, a small farming community in the Florida Panhandle. His father, Johnny, maintained the water tanks for the Seaboard Airline Railroad and ran a small store in front of the house. When Harry was 9 years old, his father died. Harry's mother, Rosa, worked hard to manage the household. She worked in cotton fields and continued to run the store her husband had established. But within the next year, Rosa felt she needed to send Harry to live with her sisters in Jacksonville, Florida. She knew this would be hard, but she also knew that her son would have few opportunities for a better life if he remained in the Florida Panhandle. Education rates for white children were low. Most children would only attend school 2 months out of the year. For Black children, there were fewer days spent in the classroom, if at all. Rosa Moore wanted more for her son. So in 1915, Harry Moore was sent to live with his aunts in the big city of Jacksonville, Florida. His aunts were professionals. Two of them were nurses. One was a teacher. Under their care, Harry was surrounded by a large and vibrant African-American community in Jacksonville. Here, Harry Moore's passion for learning was rewarded with an education his mother had dreamed of for her son. He saw strong and independent Black leaders, passionate about the arts and education. Harry spent 3 years in Jacksonville, formative years for Harry T. Moore, who then returned home in 1919. He continued his education, graduating from college in 1925 at the age of 19. And soon after, he accepted a teaching position in Cocoa, Florida. It was here that Harry met the woman he would marry, Harriet Vida Sims. She had also been a school teacher, but at the time they met, she was selling insurance. By 1926, Harry and Harriet were married and living in a small citrus town called Mims, Florida, near Cape Canaveral on the east coast of Florida. And they were rarely apart. The two were truly inseparable. Soon after the Moores moved to Mims, Florida, Harry was promoted to principal of the Titusville Colored School. Harry also owned a small orange grove that he told his wife would help provide for their retirement someday. In March of 1928, their daughter, Annie, who was also known as Peaches, was born. And in September of 1930, their second daughter, Evangeline, was born. The Moores dedicated their lives to education. They would both teach in segregated schools in and around Mims, Florida from 1925 to 1946. They lived a quiet life. They enjoyed spending their free time with their daughters, reading, playing cards, and occasionally going to the movies in Daytona Beach. As Harry's daughter Evangeline put it, if he took you to the movies, you were going to see a Western. But in 1934, Harry Moore discovered a new passion, the fight for civil rights, the NAACP. In 1934, he formed the Brevard County NAACP and served as the NAACP's first statewide executive secretary. If you're not familiar, the NAACP is a civil rights organization that was formed in 1909 as a biracial endeavor to advance justice for African Americans. From its inception, the NAACP worked to overturn disenfranchisement of blacks, which had been established in every southern state, excluding most from the political system, from voting. The organization also fought for legislation that would make lynching of African Americans a crime. Harry Moore's bold stand against racism in the state of Florida was a risk. It was a risk for any black person in the state. There was no civil rights movement in Florida in the 1930s. At the time, there wasn't even a notion of black rights because Harry Moore was living in what was called a separate but equal society of the Deep South. Black people had to use black-only restrooms and black-only water fountains, and anyone who challenged that divide in society could be punished with jail time. And even worse, if a black person challenged the system, they would often get a visit from the Ku Klux Klan. Harry T. Moore was a shy man, soft-spoken, not the first man people thought would take a stand against white supremacy in his state. But Harry Moore found his calling, and he knew he could pay a price. But he and his wife agreed that fighting for freedom and justice for all was worth it. And Harry Moore knew he couldn't back down. Harry Moore built the Brevard chapter of the NAACP into a powerful organization. In 1938, the Brevard chapter worked with the All-Black Florida State Teachers Association and the NAACP's national attorney, Thurgood Marshall, to file the first lawsuit in the Deep South calling for equal pay for all teachers, black and white. The lawsuit failed in court, but it inspired dozens of federal lawsuits that did lead to equal pay for all teachers. In 1941, Harry Moore organized the Florida State Conference of the NAACP. Moore organized letter-writing campaigns and created circulars in protest of unequal salaries, disenfranchisement of black voters, and segregation of schools. By 1943, Harry Moore expanded the efforts of the Brevard chapter of the NAACP when he worked to raise awareness of police brutality in the state and awareness of lynchings. Harry Moore was particularly moved by the lynching of 15-year-old Willie James Howard in Live Oak, Florida. Live Oak was just down the road from Harry's hometown, and Willie's mother had gone to school with Harry Moore. In December of 1943, 15-year-old Willie James Howard sent Christmas cards to all of his coworkers at a local five and dime store, including a white girl he admitted to having a crush on, a 15-year-old girl named Cynthia Goff. He expressed in the Christmas card that he hoped that one day, white people and black people could be allowed to like one another, because as he wrote to Cynthia, "I love your name, I love your voice, for a sweetheart, you're my choice." Willie James was so smitten with Cynthia and never imagined that he would offend her. But a black boy expressing his affection for a white girl was considered intimate and out of line in 1943. Days later, Willie James sent a letter to apologize to Cynthia Goff. On January 2nd, 1944, Cynthia showed that note to her father, Philip Goff, who became enraged that a black boy would express affection for his daughter. He immediately got two friends to accompany him to the home of Willie James and demanded to see the boy. Willie James' mother, Lula, begged the men to leave, but they pushed her, threatening her life and dragging her son away. Philip Goff and his friends went to the workplace of Willie James' father and kidnapped him. Willie James and his father were driven to an embankment of the Suwannee River. Willie's father was forced to watch as three white men bound the hands and feet of his son and made Willie James stand near the edge of the water. They pointed guns at Willie and told him he had a choice in how he died. He could jump or they could shoot him to death. Willie James jumped. jumped into the cold water of the Suwannee River as his father was forced to watch at gunpoint. When police questioned Philip Goff, who was a former state legislator, Goff acknowledged that he and his accomplices had taken Willie from his home, but said they only intended to discipline him, to put him in his place. Goff said that Willie James became hysterical and jumped into the river to kill himself. Harry T. Moore picked up the investigation into the lynching of Willie James. He met with Willie's parents and obtained affidavits explaining what had really happened the day Willie James was murdered. Despite the work of Harry Moore, the grand jury that was impaneled refused to hand down an indictment, which came as no surprise to Harry T. Moore and to the James family. Harry Moore continued working on the case, pursuing justice for Willie James and many more victims of lynching in the state of Florida. But as was the case in most racial terror lynchings, justice was rare for victims and their families. But Harry Moore vowed to continue to fight for justice, fight for anti-lynching legislation, which meant he needed to organize voters to help bring about change in Florida. By 1944, Harry Moore had organized the Progressive Voters League, and over the next 6 years, he traveled Florida's back roads, knocking on doors in farming communities, facing down white authorities who threatened him that he needed to stop what he was doing. It was dangerous work, and Harriet Moore insisted on going on every drive with Harry because, as she put it, if anything happened to her husband, she wanted to be with him. And the risk was always present. Oftentimes, the Moores would be followed out of town or to county lines, and when they reached the county line, the headlights from the car following them would abruptly just disappear. The message was always clear: leave and do not come back. But Harry Moore fought on. By 1946, Harry was the executive secretary of the Florida NAACP. Harry Moore was calm. He was cool and collected. He was a pleasant and likable man, which made him more and more of a threat to the forces who opposed the work of the NAACP. He often received death threats. He wasn't a violent man, but he was a self-aware man who believed in the right to bear arms and the right to defend himself and his family. Harry Moore carried a .32 caliber pistol for self-defense. He knew that at any moment, those death threats could become more than threatening letters and phone calls. Harry Moore's hard work, his calling, and his dedication to civil rights came with a price. In the summer of 1946, Harry and his wife Harriet were fired from their teaching jobs. Their political activism had upset the all-white school board that made it clear to Harry and his wife that they couldn't find work in the state. And that was true. The Moores were blacklisted from teaching in Florida. With teaching no longer an option for Harry Moore, he became a full-time paid organizer for the Florida NAACP. Over the next 2 years, Harry Moore would grow the Florida chapter to over 10,000 members within 63 branches. When Harry Moore began organizing voter registration for black voters and opening more and more chapters of the NAACP in the state, only 5% of eligible black voters were registered in Florida. Over time, over 116,000 black voters were registered in the Florida Democratic Party. Between 1946 to 1950, Harry Moore made incredible strides for change in Florida. By 1950, 31% of eligible black voters in the state were registered to vote, a figure that was 50% higher than any other southern state. A figure that was making segregationists, members of the Ku Klux Klan, nervous. 1949 would prove to be a pivotal year for Harry T. Moore's work on behalf of civil rights in the state of Florida, and a pivotal year that would make it clear that Harry Moore was not only facing opposition from white supremacists who wanted to shut down the work he was doing in the state of Florida. This was also the year Harry Moore would find himself disagreeing with the NAACP. This was due to a major move the organization made that year. The national office doubled annual dues from $1 to $2. Harry Moore was upset over the change that led to a decreased membership. Some people simply refused to pay more, and some couldn't afford more. Harry openly spoke against the decision to raise the membership fees, which led to disagreements with the national office of the NAACP. Those disagreements stemmed not only from Harry's frustration with the membership dues, but the national office increasingly disagreed with Harry Moore over his political activities, and some board members felt he wasn't spending sufficient time tending to his affairs as the executive secretary in the state. But Harry Moore continued his political activism, becoming the most visible African-American leader in Florida. So visible that Florida's governor agreed to meet with him to talk about issues important to the cause. Stopping police brutality, protecting Black voters, and creating job opportunities for Black Floridians. This was a historic meeting, the first time since Reconstruction that a Florida governor had met with a Black delegation. In the summer of 1949, a case that became known as the Groveland Four would gain national attention and drive Harry T. Moore to even more action in the fight for freedom, justice, and equality for Black Americans. The case was also said to set into motion, motivate the men who would assassinate Harry T. Moore. The Groveland Four case began on the night of July 16th of 1949. A young couple, Willie and Norma Paget, had been plagued by marital problems with accusations of domestic violence and affairs. The two weren't living together at the time, but they agreed to go out dancing at a local club to see if they could reconcile and move forward in their relationship. As they were driving home from a dance in Central Florida's Lake County, their car broke down on a country road near the town of Groveland. What happened next comes down to who you believe. The Pagets were in need of help when a car with two Black men inside stopped and offered to help push start the car. It's important to note that the Pagets would later say there were four Black men inside the car that stopped. The version the two Black men in the car, Walter Irvin and Sammy Shepard, would later tell police is that they helped Willie push his car, and after a while they all stopped to rest. Norma offered the men a sip of whiskey. They drank, and afterwards, Willie was said to make an offensive racial slur. Sammy Shepard told police he was upset, and he and Willie threw punches. And afterwards, Shepard and Irvin left and drove an hour away to a nightclub. They would drive back a few hours later so Sammy Shepard could drop Walter Irvin off at his parents' home. And they say they never saw the Pagets again that night. But the Pagets' version of that night is very different. They told police there were four Black men in the car that stopped and offered to help with the Pagets' car troubles. Instead of helping, the Black men beat up Willie and left him on the side of the road. The men then kidnapped Norma, raped her, and let her go. The chief investigator in Lake County, Florida, Sheriff Willis V. McCall, was known as a racist and a brutal lawman. He met with the Pagets, who named four men as those who had raped Norma. Within hours, Charles Greenlee, Walter Irvin, and Sammy Shepard were arrested. The fourth man, who had been accused of the crime, Ernest Thomas, escaped and would be shot over 400 times by a posse that chased him down. When rumors spread that a white woman had been raped by Black men, members of the Ku Klux Klan gathered in Groveland that night and began shooting into and burning down the homes of African Americans in the community. The Florida National Guard had to move in to restore order in Groveland. Harry T. Moore asked the Florida governor to convene a grand jury in an effort to seek justice for the violence against Blacks in Lake County that day, but a grand jury would never be convened. Based solely on the word of Norma Paget, 22-year-old Walter Irvin and Samuel Shepard were convicted and sent to death by an all-white jury. 16-year-old Charles Greenlee was also convicted and given a life sentence of hard labor. Harry Moore organized an NAACP campaign to support the Groveland defendants' appeals. Appeals for the cases of Sammy Shepard and Walter Irvin reached the U.S. Supreme Court. With the NAACP's Thurgood Marshall defending the case, the Groveland defendant's appeal was heard. And on April 9, 1951, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously overturned the convictions of Irvin and Shepard. Lake County, Florida, immediately prepared for a new trial against both men. On November 6, 1951, Sheriff Willis McCall transported Walter Irvin and Sammy Shepard back to Lake County for a pretrial hearing. During the drive, McCall claimed that the handcuffed prisoners attacked him and tried to escape, and he shot them both. Sammy Shepard died, but Walter Irvin was critically wounded. He survived. Irvin would tell his lawyer, Thurgood Marshall, and FBI agents that he and Shepard hadn't tried to escape, that Sheriff McCall had claimed to have car trouble, possibly a flat tire. The sheriff pulled over, yanked them out of the car, and just started firing. The shooting created a national outrage and scandal, with Harry Moore strongly campaigning against Sheriff McCall, demanding that the Florida governor and federal officials indict Sheriff McCall. But McCall would never be indicted for the death of Sammy Shepard. Walter Irvin was tried and once again found guilty by an all-white jury. Just 6 weeks after Harry T. Moore demanded Sheriff McCall be indicted for the murder of Sammy Shepard, Moore and his wife Harriet were assassinated. Harry T. Moore's call for justice for the Groveland Four and Moore's continued efforts to register black voters across the state of Florida led to an increasing number of death threats against him. In an interview for a PBS documentary about the life of Harry Moore, his daughter, Evangeline, noted that her father kept his .32-caliber pistol in his car and would often mention that if they came for him, he would be able to get a couple of them before they killed him. Some within the NAACP asked Harry T. Moore to get out. They were concerned that if he didn't back down on the Groveland 4 case, he may be killed. There were also clear concerns from the national office that Harry Moore was coordinating the Florida chapter on the road, away from the office, and the national office felt the Florida membership was suffering because of the lack of focus. Harry had voiced concerns over increased membership dues years before and how the dues issue was leading to a decline in membership. But by November of 1951, Harry Moore lost his position as executive secretary for the NAACP's Florida chapter. He was allowed to remain involved in the chapter in an unpaid role as state coordinator. The Moores moved to Riviera Beach so Harriet could take a teaching job to help provide for the family. Harry and Harriet would return to Mims, Florida on holidays. On Christmas Day of 1951, the Moores spent the day with family. They then returned to their Mims home to celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary. They enjoyed cake together and spent time talking and reflecting on 25 years together. Harry's mother, Rosa, and their 24-year-old daughter, Peaches, came home later that night, and they all agreed they would leave their Christmas presents in the parlor. They wanted to wait until the Moore's daughter, Evangeline, came home the next day from Washington, D.C., to open the presents together. Around 10:15 that night, Harry Moore climbed into bed, and within a few minutes, his wife, Harriet, would join him. Harry Moore turned off the light, and at that moment, it's believed that a member of the KKK lit the fuse to a massive explosive. Within seconds, a blast tore open the floor and slammed the Moore's mattress into the ceiling before the bed crashed back down. People as far away as Titusville ran from their homes to see what happened, many believing the nearby NASA Space Center had blown up. The blast destroyed the Moore's bedroom, the front porch, and snapped the joints of the six-room home. And that Christmas night, on their 25th wedding anniversary, Harry and Harriet Moore were side by side, buried under a pile of debris. Harriet Moore's brother, Master Sergeant George Sims, was home on leave that Christmas night when he felt the blast. He lived 800 yards from the Moore's home and was the first responder on the scene. Another brother of Harriet, Arnold Sims, was next on scene and helped lift Harry Moore to offer aid. Arnold would later say that as he was lifting Harry Moore, it felt as though every bone in Harry's body was broken. Arnold and George Sims carried Harriet and Harriet Moore to their Buick and rushed them to the closest hospital that would treat black patients. That meant a 30-mile drive to Sanford, Florida. Harry Moore had once told his mother that every advancement comes by way of sacrifice. His mother, Rosa, never imagined that her family would sacrifice so much. 46-year-old Harry Moore would die in his mother's arms before they arrived at the hospital that night. Harriet Moore would linger for 9 days, having suffered massive internal injuries. Before Harriet died, she made one last request. She asked to be transported to the funeral home so she could see Harry's body. It took every bit of strength Harriet had left, and her daughters maintained that the very act was a clear message that she would be leaving them soon. Every detail of Harry Moore's funeral was a reminder of the separate but equal world the Moores had been fighting to change in the Deep South. The funeral service for Harry Moore was held at a church that was large enough to accommodate the hundreds of people who came to pay their respects. But before the service, Harriet Moore's brothers worked with state investigators to search the church for explosives, aware that the threat wasn't over, even after Harry's death. And the flowers that would cover Harry Moore's casket had to be ordered from a flower shop in Miami, which was a 3-hour drive from the church. Local flower shops refused to deliver flowers to a black funeral. Harriet Moore died January 3rd, 1952, 2 days after Harry Moore was buried. The assassination of Harry and Harriet Moore was front page news in 1951. United States Delegate Eleanor Roosevelt discussed the attack at the United Nations, warning that the harm it will do among the people of the world is untold. By 3:40 a.m. on December 26, 1951, the FBI had been called in to help local authorities investigate the explosion at the Moores' home. The Ku Klux Klan was active in the area and had threatened the Moores time and time again. And the FBI knew many prominent members of the Mims community were members of the Klan, including some law enforcement and political leaders. As investigators began searching through the remains of the Moores' home, they found that the blast had blown a hole that was nearly 2 feet deep beneath the bedroom. Orlando Sentinel reporter Jim Clark wrote an extensive investigative piece about the murder in 1991. He found that the FBI knew dynamite had been used because there was no sign of a detonator, which means the person or persons behind the bombing planted the dynamite, then watched and waited until the light went out in the Moore's bedroom, then intentionally triggered the explosion. Agents blew up 2 abandoned homes at the new guided missile range at Cape Canaveral to determine how much dynamite had been used in the bombing, learning that at least 3 pounds of dynamite had been planted under the Moore's bedroom. The FBI would question hundreds of people over the course of their investigation, and they found a few leads along the way, including inside a store called Mims Confectionery. There they spoke with a black customer who remembered 2 white men who had come into the store that summer. He remembered one of them was wearing a bright red cap. The other was wearing a cowboy hat and boots. One of the men asked where the rich Professor Moore lived. The other mentioned that they wanted to find that Professor Moore that doesn't have to work and just travels around and has money. The FBI identified 2 suspects, both members of the Klan, Tillman Belvin and Earl Brooklyn, who was known for always wearing a red cap. He was also known to be a member of the Orange County KKK's Wrecking Crew, a group of men who carried out violent acts. The FBI learned from an informant that Earl Brooklyn had shown him a floor plan of Harry Moore's home, and the FBI believed at least one other man was involved, Joseph Cox. But after 2 interviews with the FBI, Joseph Cox seemed nervous. He kept asking what the FBI had uncovered. The day after his second interview, on March 30th, 1952, Joseph Cox killed himself. And after his death, the case against the Orange County KKK began to fall apart. The FBI had detailed information about the movements of suspects, but witnesses refused to talk. And all of a sudden, eyewitnesses couldn't remember what they had seen. Within a year of the bombing, all three prime suspects had died. Joe Cox, of course, had killed himself. Tillman Belvin died of natural causes in August of 1952. And Earl Brooklyn also died of natural causes on Christmas Day of 1952, 1 year to the date of the Moores murders. The FBI officially closed the investigation into the murders in 1955. But in 1978, at the request of the NAACP, the case was opened again by the Brevard County Sheriff and the state's attorney's offices. An investigator was contacted by Edward Lee Spivey, a former high-ranking Klansman. Spivey was dying of cancer, said to want to clear his conscience. Spivey implicated his friend and fellow Klansman, Joseph Cox. Spivey claimed that Joseph Cox came to him the day after his second FBI interview and confessed that he had been paid $5,000 to plant the bomb and had used the money to pay off the mortgage on his home. Cox was paranoid and afraid that when the FBI looked into him, they would find out about the mortgage payment and realize he was part of the bombing. Joseph Cox asked to borrow Spivey's shotgun, went home, and killed himself. But officials became convinced that Edward Spivey had also been at the house when Joseph Cox planted the bomb, but they were never able to get answers. Spivey died soon after the investigation was reopened, and once again, the investigation was closed. Since 1978, several attempts to open and solve the case have been made, but the case officially remains unsolved. In 2004, the Florida Attorney General ordered another investigation. This was due to requests from the Moore's daughter, Evangeline, who had for decades been unable to speak about what had happened to her parents. In fact, she and her sister would never speak of it. The pain was too much to speak aloud. Peaches would die at the age of 44 from complications of asthma. Evangeline blamed the smoke her sister inhaled the night of the explosion. The 2004 investigation pursued different possible motives for the murder of the Moores, including the question as to whether Sheriff Willis McCall was involved in the murders. After all, the Groveland 4 case led Harry Moore to call for Willis to lose his job and be indicted. The 2004 investigation found that Moore's activities in defense of the Groveland 4 angered the Klan and local law enforcement, but found no direct evidence linking the Moore bombing to the Groveland case or to Sheriff McCall. The investigation would close with the same conclusion as previous investigations, that Orange County KKK members Joe Cox, Tillman Belvin, Earl Brooklyn, and Edward Spivey had carried out the bombing. Evangeline Moore died in 2015 at the age of 85. For the remainder of her life, Evangeline would be haunted by those who killed her father and mother. They were never punished, and Evangeline was understandably frustrated and at times heartbroken that her father's contributions to the civil rights movement are relatively unknown. But she refused to let hate enter her heart. In 2009, Evangeline told the Orlando Sentinel that on her deathbed, her mother, Harriet, had told her that she never wanted her to even think about hating white people or anyone because it would make her ugly, and she didn't want her daughter to be an ugly woman. The Christmas Day bombing that killed the Moores may have come years before Martin Luther King Jr. or Medgar Evers were murdered for the civil rights movement, but the Moores share in the legacy of the fight for civil rights in America. In the words of Harry T. Moore, freedom never descends upon a people. It is always bought with a price. In 1952, Harry T. Moore was posthumously awarded the Springarn Medal by the NAACP for outstanding achievement by an African American. The same year, Langston Hughes memorialized the fallen civil rights pioneer with a ballad of Harry Moore. Writing these poignant words about Moore's legacy and how he should be remembered. So should you see our Harry Moore walking on a Christmas night, don't run and hide, you killers. He has no dynamite. In his heart is only love for all the human race, and all he wants is for every man to have his rightful place. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. This episode has only scratched the surface of the life and the work of Harry T. Moore. You can find resources to help you learn more about his life in the complete show notes at southernmysteries.com. There you'll also find a link to listen to the latest episode of the Color Line Murders podcast that tells the full story of Willie James Howard, the 15-year-old murder victim that Harry Moore felt so personally connected to. This is the final episode of Southern Mysteries for the year, but I was honored to be invited to be a part of another podcast. My friends at Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, they explore unsolved homicides and missing person cases throughout the state of Texas. They've produced a special holiday episode that features fellow podcasters sharing why they're inspired to launch podcasts and true crime cases that haunt them or motivate them to continue telling the stories of victims of crime. I was honored to be included in a special episode sharing about a Jackson, Mississippi case that still haunts me and motivates me to tell stories of true crime victims here in Southern Mysteries and in my true crime podcast, The Color Line Murders. Make sure you add Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, to your list of pods to check out this week. I'll be sure to share a link on my social media channels. I'm on Twitter at Mysteries Pod, and on Facebook, you can search Southern Mysteries Podcast to join the podcast group. And no, this may be the final episode of Southern Mysteries for the year, but I will be back in the new year on January the 7th with a new episode for you. Make sure you subscribe to the show and share this episode with your friends and encourage them to listen. And of course, rate and review Southern Mysteries so other people can discover the podcast. My year has been brighter because of you. Your kind words and encouragement throughout this year have just meant the world to me. Thank you so much for listening to Southern Mysteries. I can't wait to share new stories with you in 2019.